Is there anything we should talk about this morning?
I've been going back over, is it Larry Rosenberg's book, Breath by Breath? Mm-hmm. And one of the things in there that really has been striking me again, but at a deeper level, is in the chapter on silence. And he speaks about the importance of not trying.
Of not what?
Not trying. Not even thinking about the direction you're trying to take your meditations in. Thinking about technique. Just simply sitting with the breath. Mm-hmm. And when I first read that, I didn't understand it. I couldn't identify with what he was saying. And then I read in the back of the book more of the Anapanasati Sutra. Mm-hmm. I think I'm probably saying that wrong.
No.
Where the Buddha talks about, the awareness of the breath, breathing in and knowing that I'm breathing in, breathing out, knowing that I'm breathing out, breathing in and knowing it's a long breath, breathing out one inhale. And then Larry sort of takes that and it speaks about that in more detailed terms. And I found it so interesting. This is more of a comment, and I'd like you to maybe expand on it. About the not trying, being absolutely with the way things are, absolutely in the moment, life being what it is right now. And that's the portal. And the no technique is a very interesting part of that. Would you speak to that, please? Because that really seems to be, and that's where my meditations have been going and are, and I'm finding that brings you to a profound state of peace and tranquility and equanimity. But it's the no technique piece and no direction, the not wanting, the not trying.
Well, there's some subtleties to that, because actually you could interpret this in a way that would be it wouldn't work, it would be unproductive. You have to have, there has to be a sense of direction, a willingness to make the appropriate effort for the meditation to succeed. But the most appropriate time for that is when it's just before you begin your sit, when you sit yourself down on the cushion, you collect your thoughts. That's actually a very good time to reflect on how your meditation's going and what direction you would like to go, and, recognizing the things that you need to work on and so forth. If you do that, it creates a certain mindset. And that's very valuable, and that's very, very useful. So we're not saying that your approach to meditation should be totally without direction and effort and the desire to make progress and eventually achieve the fruits of the meditation, because that should all be there. But that shouldn't be there when you start to do the practice. You want to be fully present, with no expectations and no judgments, just sitting there breathing, observing the breath. If your mind wanders, you bring it back, but you don't judge. You don't get involved in how I'm supposed to do this, the way you'd like it to be, anything like that. Same thing if you experience dullness. You just do what's appropriate. You just be in the moment and do what is appropriate. Because there's a couple of things. Any insertion of expectations and desires as to the quality of your meditation is actually going to agitate your mind and impair that, lead to restlessness, impatience, frustration, and even in very subtle forms, these can really disrupt your meditation. That subtle growing sense of impatience with the way your mind is behaving. If you can let go of that, then the problem itself, the problems that you're having, will take care of themselves. So that's one sense. The other thing is that in all of this, the way we're naturally thinking is there is this self who's in charge, my mind. I should be able to make my mind do what I want it to do. Right? Mm-hmm. Or there is a self that has goals and directions and so on and so forth. And that's the very illusion that you're trying to get beyond in your practice. And so if you're sitting there having those kinds of I thoughts, I, my, me, that's counterproductive to the practice as well. You're trying to sit there and be as you really are. And there isn't this self that's in charge making the decisions. So you want to get away from that. As far as what it says in the Anapanasati Sutra, what those words resonate in terms of my experience is that there is a stage in a person's meditation practice where to focus the attention on the cycle of the breath is an active process. It involves a sort of thinking and people often use and be encouraged to use verbal labels and things like that to help them to follow the breath. But over time, a certain familiarity develops so that it's totally unnecessary to think about the breath cycle. You've watched so many thousands of breaths that, when you look at a human being, you don't think to yourself, oh, that's his head, yeah, oh, those are his hands, right? You don't have to do that. It's instantaneous. It's immediate. It's without thought, without elaboration. It's just your fully present awareness. And you reach that same point in your meditation. And as you do, there's a certain immediacy to things like, you know that this breath is longer than the last. You don't have to think of it. It's not a thought process like, oh, yeah, this seems like it's a little longer than the last one. That doesn't happen. It's just, you know. And I think that's what the Anapanasati Sutra is speaking to. It's speaking to that level of familiarity, that level of, the mind has become really calm and really clear, and you're fully present. And you know what's happening in the moment because you're fully present with it. When I speak of the clarity of the mind, is also the quality of your conscious awareness is reflected in that clarity, so that the degree and extent of your knowing of what's happening in the present moment is significantly greater than it is in our ordinary daily lives. And that's the mindful awareness that we're cultivating. So mindfully you breathe in, mindfully breathe out. When you breathe in a long breath, you know you breathe in a long breath. And when you breathe out a long breath, you know you breathe out a long breath. And likewise for short breath. So that's what that's addressing there. It's pointing the direction that you want to go. Yeah, so you get that direction in your mind clear when you read those words and before you sit down to meditate. And then when you meditate, you don't worry about that. You let it take care of itself. It's interesting. There's a lot of subtlety to these instructions. Larry Rosenberg writes a book, and Joseph Goldstein writes a book, and all these different people write a book. And we all have the little phrases and statements that we make. We're trying to convey something of the essence of these things. And it's, for something that is so simple, it's amazing how difficult it can be for someone to truly grasp what's being said. As someone who's been meditating with me for years, I know you've heard me say it many times when I'm giving somebody instruction, you realize that your attention has gone to something other than the breath. You very gently bring your attention back. Here's a person that's been meditating with me for years, and he says, I never really got it. I'd always been forcefully moving my attention. So even though, and as a matter of fact, he's given meditation instruction himself, and I wouldn't be at all surprised to find out he hadn't used exactly those same words, gently bring your attention back. But he never really got the subtlety of it until quite recently. And he was telling me about that and encouraging me to make sure that other people understood that. So when you know what's happening is you're reading Larry Rosenberg, and there's something that you've really appreciated the subtlety of the instruction. It might be something that you'd already read even two or three times before, but you didn't quite get it the first few times. But then now all of a sudden, yes.
It's hard to. It's almost like a brain phenomenon, like that RAS, the RAS system in us, the reticular activating system. You don't recognize something until you've ingested it, sort of you've incorporated or it's become part of you. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as you hear it, you see it. Mm-hmm. So the first time I read the Anapanasati Sutra, I didn't get it.
Yeah.
Not really. Until I started to experience it. Then going back, the words are living. They're living now.
Mm-hmm.
And I, again, was so struck by... So you're saying then that it's almost... I may not still understand it. You're saying that prior to sitting on the cushion, so to speak, that you're forming an intention.
Mm-hmm.
You're getting a sense of your direction.
Yeah.
And that you're going to concentrate on the breath. But then once you're really on the cushion, then you're just really right here.
And
in a moment becomes very vivid.
And, you know, it's really very simple. Any other kind of mental activity that involves judging or craving or anything else like that is not what you want to do, and it's going to get in the way. But those things happen at a very subtle level in our mind. And it's getting to the place of recognizing just how truly present, what it means to be really, truly present, and to not be doing those extraneous activities of judging. And, you know, back to another theme of mind, that we're trying to bring about a unification of mind. And what does it mean that the mind is not unified? Well, the degree that you're sitting there, and a large part of your mental capacity is devoted to following the breath, but some other part of your mental capacity is sitting there in the background and judging, criticizing, being annoyed because your mind is wandering. Well, that's another part of your mind doing something different still. Now, that's the degree to which our mind is not unified. Mm-hmm. And it's when all of these parts start to function together, you know, and then that brings you to an experience that you can only describe as powerful, because it has the power of all of these different aspects of your mind working together. Yeah.
So it seems like the tricky part of that for me is that when part of me notices that there are a bunch of parts of my mind doing something other than watching the breath,
mm-hmm.
then I can bring it back to the breath, mm-hmm. and I can like really try, you know, like really put effort into not letting those other parts of my mind wander. Mm-hmm. And that works for a time, you know.
Yeah.
And I can even get physical phenomena that sort of point to the fact that I'm succeeding, you know, that I am pretty unified in mm-hmm. for several breaths or whatever.
Right.
But it seems that doing it with that kind of effort mm-hmm. is ultimately counterproductive to really long, sustained periods of true unification of mind. And so finding a way to bring my attention back gently, you mm-hmm. know, and without that real effort of trying is what I'm still working on figuring out. You know, that's really tricky for me.
Yes, and it takes some time. And it takes being in a place of acceptance that, well, yes, this is the way my mind tends to work. To a certain degree, everybody's mind tends to work this way. The one part of your mind will try to use force and willpower and coercion to make the other parts of your mind behave. So you're not going to be able to. You're not going to be able to make that stop happening like that. So you have to accept that it's happening. But at the same time, this is, you have the intention that you're going to get beyond this, and you're going to be as gentle as possible. And you realize your mind is being drawn off into something else. You don't need to do that forceful, abrupt, you know, yanking your attention back. You can just take a brief moment and just be there with what's happening, disengage, you know, gently disengage, gently bring the attention back, and gently make that effort to stay with the breath. And as you repeat that, it gets easier and easier and more natural. So, on the other hand, and it's a conditioning. The more often you do that, the more natural that becomes. And the more you allow the sort of normal tendency we have to forcefully redirect the attention, then the more likely that is to happen the next time. Whatever you do repeatedly conditions itself. So, and you may even find, initially you might find that using a lot of willpower, you feel like, well, at least my mind stays on the object longer, and here I'm trying to be gentle and it goes away quicker. But I would suggest that you don't worry about that, because what you're going to find is, even though your attention goes away, you're going to be aware of it sooner, you're going to make the correction, and eventually it's going to all work its way out. So just patience, creating the right conditions. And, you know, I think it's easy to imagine your mind as consisting of a sort of executive boss function and all these poorly behaved subsidiary functions. But there's really no boss. That's the part that's the illusion. And what you have to do, taming the mind, means getting all these different parts of your mind to start working together in harmony. It's like achieving a consensus. It's not even a democratic majority rule situation. You got to achieve a consensus in your mind.
The conceptual dichotomy that you're talking about of the, you know, superintendent manager and then the sort of subsidiaries that aren't doing what they're supposed to do versus consensus seems like the internal, like microcosmic expression of the worldwide paradigm shift that's going on right now, moving from this hierarchical, patriarchal, this is the right way, that's the wrong way, sort of God-fearing mm-hmm. thing, to a much more gentle, like letting go, kind mm-hmm. of, you know, surrendering to the larger picture, more equality between people, like all that stuff, like fostering this inside and fostering it outside mm-hmm. will complement each other.
Yes. Yes. As human beings mature spiritually, then it manifests in the change in their behavior. And even though society, human society as a whole, has been undergoing a very gradual process of this maturation, individuals within it have been achieving the most profound degrees of this for thousands of years. But in each of us, the more we come to be at peace with ourselves in our own mind, then the more natural it is to be at peace with everyone else in the rest of the world. The more loving and accepting we are of those different aspects of ourselves, the more willing we are to treat other people in that way, to be more forgiving, more understanding. You know? And even looking at how you treat yourself when your mind wanders away from the meditation object, when somebody breaks the law, then the emperor commands the captain of the guard to grab that person and flog them. You know. But although we haven't reached the point in society where we react on this, we've reached the point in society where we see that all human beings that do things that are destructive to society have the potential to, you know, rather than being punished and locked up, have the potential to have those tendencies corrected. And that's what we have to do with ourselves, is stop being the despot in our own head. Just like in real life, too. One person's the despot until he gets overthrown by somebody else. And that other one's the despot. Same thing happens in our minds. One part of our mind is wearing the hat that says it's the self, it's me, I'm in charge. You know, and then a few hours later it's changed and it's completely different. Mm-hmm. Right?
But then there's the watcher.
Yes. That's the interesting thing, that behind all of this there is this continuity of conscious experience, something much, much deeper and more wonderful taking place. And, you know, when all of the noise up front quiets down, then you start to become aware of that watcher, and the wisdom of that watcher starts to come forward. I mean, really what we're talking about, how does anyone ever discover the nature of their mind? Not through these different parts of your mind that are struggling for ascendancy and trying to assert their theory of what's the best thing that this entity should be doing. It's because behind this, there is this process of conscious awareness. And the wisdom that the watcher acquires, it's when that comes forward that we start to understand our nature and see where the possibilities are for changing the way we experience the world and ourselves. Then it becomes possible to become truly happy and to stop engaging in the more destructive aspects of what we do. The witness. There is one of the things that we can all experience when we discover that when we quiet the mind, we start to discover the still point. We realize that there really is like a still point, like the center of the vortex, and everything else moves around. Everything. You know, mental activities, emotions, external activities, everything is in constant motion. But there is this still point that's like the center of the vortex. And in that still point, there is this consciousness that is just watching it all unfold. And that's a place that we want to get to being able to experience. Well, when you do that, then the wisdom just starts to unfold out of that. Stop being attached to all of this stuff. Because really, that the experience that you have of that, when you have it, is that the self that I thought I was all along isn't really my true self at all. That if there's anything about me that deserves to be regarded as the true self, it is this watcher from the still point that has this wisdom and knows better than to get involved in all of this stuff going on around. And then if from that place of understanding you look at other people and you realize, well, they're all exactly the same. And the watcher in the still point and your mind and your mind and your mind is really absolutely indistinguishable from that in myself. So all the differences between us are just this superficial stuff that's going on around somewhere else.
Do you think that watcher is the place where we interconnect with each other?
It's the place that we can... I find it's the place that we can most clearly recognize and understand that we're all of one single nature. Because you realize when you experience that place, it's not determined by or conditioned by any of this other stuff going on around it. And in that sense, the consciousness that experiences from my perspective is totally indistinguishable from the consciousness that experiences from anybody else's. It's only the superficial stuff that's different. In its essence, it's exactly the same. When we realize, however we come to realize it, when we realize, you know, when we find a way to apply the words that ultimately we're all the same, then that causes a shift in all of our perceptions and the way we think and act. You know, we realize that, yes, we are all one. And as a matter of fact, like in the analogy of Indra's net, that watcher in the still point is like, that's like every single jewel, and it's all part of the same thing. Everything reflects everything else. And that it is even a separate, you know, there's still, when you have the experience of the washer, there's still the sense of there being a separation. That's illusory too. Right? And you eventually go beyond that. But that's the point at which you realize that all these other parts of the illusion that you see as separate really can't be. They really aren't. That we're all the same at that level. You know, and even something, you know, we all bleed and hurt the same, right? When you get down to it, there are many different ways that we can recognize our sameness. But when you can actually have the experience of that says, this is more truly what I am than any of the things that I normally think, and that this that I am is obviously the same thing that everyone else is, then it has an even more profound influence.
Then the discovery, I don't know how recent it was, among perhaps neurologists about these mirror cells.
Yeah.
Could be then the mechanism that we human beings seem to have, and other beings probably as well to one degree or another, that we're able to see this connection that we have. And it may also, perhaps, might it be what is the watcher then? Because not only, because we're watching ourselves, I mean, mm-hmm. we're mirroring to ourselves.
Yeah.
So that's kind of an interesting thing. And whenever you see a image of Indra's net, like you can go on the internet and explore it, and it'll have these juncture points. And they're like jewels there, like mm-hmm. diamonds or jewels. And they're reflecting every other thing in Indra's net, totally reflecting. So, I mean, I guess it's not a question, but it's an interesting phenomena that we have within ourselves, this watcher, this intrinsic ability to watch not only ourselves, but to watch how we connect to everything else.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty beautiful.
I don't know, does everyone else know about mirror neurons, what she's talking about there? No? Never heard of those? That's a really interesting thing. we take it for granted that we understand to a certain degree what other people feel and think and what it's like to be them. You know, we do that all the time, never question how. Neurologists discovered an interesting thing, that there's neurons in the brain that if I watch you do something, then exactly the same neurons that would be activated in my brain if I did it are activated when I see you do it. Okay? And one of the things that this led to, that you probably are familiar with, is that athletes can watch videotapes of athletes performing things, and just by watching that, then their own performance improves. And that's a result of mirror neurons that are mirroring motor activities, muscle activities and movements and things like that. But what they found is that there's mirror neurons associated with other parts of the brain that are involved with other mental functions. And so if you see somebody else frowning or crying, it activates mirror neurons in your brain that are the same ones that are activated when you're experiencing certain emotions that would cause you to frown or you to cry. Okay? Which the neuroscientists suggest is how we have that empathic, we see somebody frown and we know how they feel, right? And it even goes, when we see somebody engaging in complex activities, there's a whole little dance of neurons in our brain, different parts of our brain, that are mirroring what we're watching. And the suggestion is, when we have that sense of, you know what somebody is thinking, what they're planning to do, you know, why they're doing what they're doing. And this is how you know that. It's being mirrored in your own brain. And so when you do that, you know what it means. And so when those same neurons are activated, you know what somebody else is thinking. The neuroscientists have started, they call it mind reading. They say that mirror neurons are what allow us to read other people's minds. Because they refer to mind reading as that sense we have of what other people are feeling, what other people are thinking, what their intentions are. And we all know how much we always do that, right? We read, interpret the body language, the tone of voice, and all these other things.
But we're often very wrong.
Well, that's true. We're often wrong.
Good point.
But usually we're wrong in the sense that we may be very accurate about interpreting what a person's doing. Where we go wrong is when we interpret why they're doing it and what kind of a person they are. they're doing this because, and then the motivation we comes up, and then we, and they are this bad, evil person for doing that.
Well, that seems to go back to what Pam was saying, that we can't recognize something outside of us unless we felt it inside ourselves to begin
with. Right.
So if you see somebody frowning, then you associate how you felt when you were frowning,
exactly.
And you jump to the conclusion that they feel it for the same reason that you did.
Exactly, yeah. Right. So there's a limitation on that.
Or you think, oh, they don't like me.
That's right.
Oh, yeah. They really like
well,
me.
Well, and that's the interpretation. You know, that's where, when we pay attention to something, we tend to interpret what we're paying attention to in terms of how it impacts us, very subjectively. And although there's many possible explanations for why somebody might frown, and you even know that, your mind is going to gravitate towards the one that impacts you the most.
Right. The one that makes me the center of the universe.
That's right. The one that makes me the center of the universe. Exactly. So you just naturally assume they're frowning because they disapprove of you. When it was really indigestion.
So that maybe means we haven't refined it well enough. Our watcher or our connections are just not refined enough. And perhaps if we move out of this place of the self, our feeling, as she said, the center of the universe, we would move to a more universal way of understanding things.
Yes, and that seems to be the best way that we have to do that, is to make that change, is to work on, you know, to recognize how self-centered we are. To recognize, if you can even say, well, there's my mind making me the center of the universe again, but I wonder what's really going on. You know? Or even better yet, putting yourself in the place of the other person in a way that instead of, oh, she's frowning, must mean she disapproves of me. Instead, she's frowning, obviously something bothers her. I wonder what bothers her.
Mm-hmm.